Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, in the 2.5 weeks since the shooting at Butler High, guns are discovered at an alarming rate at other schools around the county. City Council moves another step closer to serving four-year terms. Not everyone is in favor. The I-77 toll road won't make the deadline for being fully operational by the end of the year, but will they pay fines for which are spelled out in the contract. I wish I could read what I wrote. And Atrium Health and the North Carolina and United States Justice Department settled a 2016 antitrust lawsuit about health care pricing. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more, and they are Alex Olgan from WFAE News. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Doss Helms is here, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Good morning.
Hello to you. And Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, where he has just ascended to the throne. the position of, are you editor and pub? No.
No. I'm managing editor, but we're all day to day, as you know, Mike. So.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
I think.
Who knows? Well, yeah.
Just under 3 weeks ago, we had the fatal shooting at Butler High School in Matthews, followed the very next day by the discovery of a student with a gun at Garinger. Then guns were confiscated from students. I hope I have the sequence correct here. Students at Hopewell High in Huntersville. This week on Tuesday, a scare at Olympic about a gun on campus. Police tracked down the suspects off campus, found a gun, arrested three students. All this while a gun was found at East Meck the same day. And the same day, a student at Eastway Middle School was found with a pocket taser. All of this in the course of about 2 weeks. How many weapons does that make, Ann?
Well, guns and weapons are technically different in the way they report. I think they're saying they've had 7 firearm incidents. I think there must have been 1 or 2 before things got really hairy with the actual shooting. Mm-hmm. But it's a high pace. We've always had a fair number of guns confiscated at Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools.
Well, I was going to ask, is it really a high pace? Are we seeing more of this because these are copycat things, that they see these guns coming in, so I'm going to bring a gun for my protection, or I'm going to cause a ruckus because everybody's carrying a gun? Or is it that people are more vigilant now and we're finding these guns that have been coming in at this rate all along?
Well, that's always been the big question, and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools has traditionally, when the state comes out several months after a school year is over, they give their tally of self-reported data, and Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools traditionally has more guns than any other district, including Wake, which is larger. I think the last official tally we have, it was like 19 guns, so that's a lot, and they don't always get reported in the news because CMS is not going to put out a news release necessarily, and it tends to be when we hear about it from parents. What CMS will say is we confiscate them when we hear about it from students. So
has the Observer or any other news organization gone in and asked to see private records or the records that they keep on guns in schools that don't get reported?
Well, now I'm trying to figure out. They don't get reported necessarily in real time. So what happens is we ask and see them. But the details of the individual students are not necessarily available. Okay. But the incidents are reported.
Glenn.
Last night at Johnson C. Smith, CMPD held the first of its Bridging the Difference community monthly community forums leading up to the DNC convention. And that topic actually came up. Some of the parents spoke quite passionately about the level of fear in schools. I don't know if more guns are coming into school or if people are just being more diligent about finding them, but it was really interesting listening to the parents talk about the level of fear among some students, whether we're talking about on the buses or on the schools. Apparently, there is a bullying problem.
Not to minimize the fear in schools, because it's certainly legitimate when you look at the number of mass shootings. But really, I read a statistic this morning that there are 55 million school children in the United States. And when you put the 55 million up against the number who have been threatened with or injured by or killed by a gun in school, the numbers are tiny.
Yeah, but
Probability versus possibility is different. I think people see the possibility that it could happen to them as higher than the actual mathematical probability.
Well, I don't think the fear goes to mass shootings as much as fear of that person who might beat me up,
right,
or that other person who might have a weapon. So I need to have one to protect myself.
Well, I was going to ask Ann, since she's more immersed in this than any of the rest of us, given what we just talked about and what's going on, I wonder if, and what the superintendent is going to talk about today, I wonder how much conversation there is that you hear about trying to balance between the fear, the possibility, and overreaction, doing too much.
Oh, I think that's a huge issue. And, you know, lockdowns happen with some frequency. I've got a request in to see actually how many they've had and what they've been about. But this generation of kids has grown up with lockdown drills and with actual lockdowns that happen if there's a crime in the neighborhood or if a stranger wanders into school and they're not sure who it is. And so to some extent, it's kind of a, you know, become a routine thing. But as this anxiety ratchets up, I spoke yesterday afternoon with a 12-year-old who they had a lockdown that turned out to be very minor at his school, but he sat down and started writing a farewell letter to his mom because he didn't have a cell phone, and he put his address at the top in case that was the only way they would know which mom this letter was to.
Wow.
You know, that's – so CMSs and principals and teachers are always having to recalculate, do we make this routine to avoid fear, or do we make a point of notifying parents because that fear is out there? And if you find out after the fact and your child is traumatized and you haven't heard anything from the school, you may be upset.
So when they locked down Butler High School during that shooting, parents kind of ignored police and walked across the street and tried to get into the school to get their children out during the incident that occurred at Olympic High School. Parents also jammed the streets outside the school, and one of them was a man named Myron Barnes.
What can we do to really solve this issue? This is the fourth school that there's been a threat of gun violence or gun violence within a month span. We've had Butler, Geringer, Hopewell, and now Olympic, and this has to stop.
So what are you hearing from parents?
Well, you know, there's a lot of anxiety. I don't think there is any unanimous decision on what the solution is. You always, anytime there's one of these stories, you get a lot of comments online saying metal detectors, screening, and I guess we'll see. At 1:30 this afternoon, Clayton Wilcox is supposed to talk about what his next steps are going to be. Again, I don't know how practical it is to do that on a universal basis, but I think this parent fear, that's part of what they have to balance, is when do you let parents know in real time? How do you handle them? I think the feeling was that Olympic was probably a little better handled than Butler was because they'd had some preparation.
Do school systems across the country talk to each other? Are there not best practices out there that would help them come up with?
I'm sure there are. There are conferences, there are consultants, but again, it's one thing to sort of know in theory. It's right. Another thing, there are 176 schools here. Each one has a different physical layout, a different staff. You know, I think at Olympic, the traffic to me was scary because people just, you know, when you are coming and they don't let you onto campus when there's any possibility that there's a gunman there. So people were just piling along the roads. And by the time I was trying to leave, you had these little narrow lanes. Yeah. And you had people taking their kids out, walking in the street. You had people pulling up with, you know, their younger kids in strollers. I mean, I was just, you know, my gut was clenched because I didn't want to hit somebody and I didn't want anybody else to get injured in the traffic.
So CMS Police Chief Lisa Mangum was asked if authorities are confident they'll get a handle on this problem of guns in school.
Yes, we believe we can. We are steadily evaluating our safety plans. We're in talks with our community, with our partners in law enforcement, to come up with a way to keep the guns out of our schools. That is probably our most critical thought process right now, is how do we stop the guns from coming onto our campus?
So are we to anticipate then that Clayton Wilcox today will come up with some of the things they've decided to do? I mean, that's what she's talking about?
Yes, I think there are a number of things that are already in progress. There's always been awareness of this. It got higher after the shooting in Florida. It got higher after Butler. And I think Clayton Wilcox has said that he's willing to consider measures, including physical screening type measures, that he really did not want to go to.
Which would include what, wanding and metal detectors and one entrance for schools, et cetera, right?
Well, I think that's what we'll find out is, again, just how extreme one would go on that. And these shootings just show how hard it is. It's not like you can target three or four schools that are a big risk. It's been all over the place.
And let's be clear, unless we're really prepared to do that, it's going to be very difficult to get guns out of schools unless we can establish some type of TSA type.
That's what I was going to say. This feels like flying. Yeah. There's a before and after.
Wow. On the day that both Olympic and East Mecklenburg High Schools had gun incidents, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Youth Council met to address school safety. The timing was coincidental. This was planned before those incidents took place. The goal for the meeting was to hear from students about what they needed to help keep them safe. And the students said that not only do weapons have to be kept out of schools, but officials need to focus on why students would ever think to bring a weapon to school. And they got an earful. One student told CMS to give up. She said, quote, "You fail. Let the parents take this over. Start with metal detectors and go from there. You can talk till you're blue in the face, but you aren't doing anything to change that. Talk is cheap, especially when it comes from CMS." What was the reaction to that? Because they were sitting there, including Clayton Wilcox.
Yeah, and I did not, I was not physically there. You know, it was a big table full of people, so I did not hear a response to that. But I do think that CMS deserves credit for having a lot of people there. Right. They had almost all their top staff. They had Clayton Wilcox. They sat there for probably close to 90 minutes, and the adults just sat down at the table with the youth and listened.
Rocky River High School student Amaya Burse brought up the subject of bullying, which you alluded to earlier, Glenn. She asked for a show of hands of students who had been bullied, and then when she asked if a teacher had done anything about that bullying, all of the hands went down.
That's concerning. So we're having issues of us telling our teachers, us telling administration, and the worst thing that they do is they suspend the student. The best that that's going to do is make it worse, because now the student's going to come back and say, oh, I came back from vacation, now we're going to fight. Which, personally to me, I feel like that is causing a lot of students to feel, well, if the adults aren't going to help me, I have to protect myself. I'm not saying I would ever bring a gun, because Lord knows, no. But a lot of students are feeling like adults aren't protecting us. Adults aren't helping us. We're going to people and telling them this is happening, and nobody is helping us, nobody is listening to us.
Did anyone from CMS respond to that? Do you know?
No, this was, you know, this was
they were just listening.
They were just listening. I mean, there were comments at the end, and Clayton Wilcox said he wants to keep hearing from them.
Well, here's what he said at the end of that meeting.
You're going to see in the next couple of days that we are going to talk loudly and proudly about what we will do to keep you safe. But we also need you then to echo back to us when we haven't done that job well. Because quite frankly, we will be better when we listen to the kids that we serve.
So he wants to hear from kids. Is there a mechanism in place for that communication to take place? Can that word get to him or people just below him when the kids are really concerned about things?
Well, I believe he does have a student advisory council, and that's tends to be, you know, highly engaged student leaders from all of the different high schools and Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. One of the things that this group pointed out, and it was a packed room, the students were very interested in this, but they were saying in some ways that the difficult group to reach is the kids who will never come to a meeting like this. You know, these are the engaged students. Mm-hmm. What about the kids who are not engaged at all at school, who are not in clubs, who are not, you know, talking to teachers or counselors, who are potentially at the most risk of being either victims or potentially perpetrators?
Well, we'll be talking about this for months to come, I'm certain of it. When we come back, four-year terms, really? Gerrymandering, lawsuits flying, Bill James, quiet.
Everybody getting along.
Oh, my.
Oh, my. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with our roundtable of reporters for the weekly news roundup. Eric Spanberg, who will be your humble host on this program on Monday. Well, maybe not so humble, because he's now the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Glenn Berkins is here, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. And Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. And Alex Olgan from our newsroom at WFAE News. This week, the Charlotte City Council's Budget and Effectiveness Committee voted 3-2 to recommend 4-year staggered terms for city council people, and I guess the mayor, beginning in 2021. The two Republicans on council, and therefore the two Republicans on that committee, and therefore the two Republicans in office
in Charlotte.
In Charlotte. Ed Driggs and Tariq Bukhari voted no. Where is this move to 4-year terms coming from? Who is spearheading this?
Well, this is one that, other than Alex, the rest of us have been here a long time. We've heard this percolate from time to time.
This comes up periodically.
Yes, it does. 2011, I think, was the last time for the council. 2015 for the county commission. So Braxton Winston, at his first business meeting as a council member, which was in 2017, brought this up. Said, we need to have longer terms that we can't do our business, in essence, with a part-time job. And so it has gained momentum from there. And you're right, Mike. Other than the two Republicans, it seems like everybody else on council is pretty much in favor of this.
Yeah. When it has come up before and it didn't go anywhere, why didn't it go anywhere?
I think public outcry was a big part of it.
Why are we opposed to that in Charlotte?
Well, I think part of it is this is the way it's always been done. I think another part is the fear of not being able to throw people out after 2 years if you're unhappy with them. And then there's another argument of, hey, this works for Congress, this works for the state legislature, why is city council different?
And it actually works for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board.
Right.
I believe the state legislature set it up that way when they created the district seat. So it is the staggered, you know, you'll have 1 year, you'll have the district seats, and then 2 years later you have the at-large seats. And of all the things that people get mad at the school board for, I don't think I've heard a lot of outcry about 4-year terms.
And proponents of 4-year terms might have a point, but it just seems so self-serving.
Well, Democrat LaWanna Mayfield believes that council would be more effective at representing the community because they'd have more time to settle into their jobs. And we've heard this from several newcomers, particularly, settle into their jobs and learn about issues without worrying about re-election all the time. Now, I asked the mayor about her position on 4-year terms on this program yesterday. She seemed pretty reluctant to wade into this, but she did say that the final decision should be up to the voters and should not be based on how much time it takes to run for office.
I think the question for all of us is, what would it mean? What difference would it make? And you have to be able to articulate that. Now, personally for me, the difference would be perhaps that you wouldn't have to have a campaign every 2 years, but that's not a sufficient reason.
She also said that candidates for mayor and city council file for office. They will file for office in July of next year, 2019, for a September primary and a November election. That does not seem like a long election cycle or something that you're going to spend a whole year worrying about. Does she have a point?
Well, I would back up from there and say that I think the thing about what the mayor is saying is interesting. I've been amazed all along that the council members who are supporting these longer terms keep saying, well, you know, you come in and you can do things for 14, 15 months, and then you just have to stop. I mean, it's such a blatant admission that, hey, I'm not going to tackle anything that could endanger my reelection chances when we get within 9 months.
So it's not about collecting money or knocking on doors and canvassing. It's
about
not doing anything that might endanger you.
I mean, at least that's how I interpret it. And you know, typically when we have a tax conversation, there have been some exceptions. It's usually in an off year.
But then the inverse of that, or the converse of that, is that if you have 4-year terms, you get in there and you can do anything.
Yes.
But you know, if you have
for the middle 2 years.
Yes, and I think there's a fear of that.
If you have 4-year terms, it's still an election year every 2 years for somebody on that board. So if the idea is that you're going to back away from anything controversial, that doesn't really change.
Yeah. This is one, I think Glenn made a good point. It just rankles people. It feels self-serving.
And yet, if you look at the Congress, the House of Representatives is elected every 2 years, and the Senate is every 6 years on staggered terms. And the Senate, who has been in, they have longer terms, are the more deliberative, more sane body, if you take a look at the two houses of Congress. So does that defeat that argument?
That's a good question. I mean, I would start with a lot of the council members when I've asked them about this say, well, you can't compare this to Congress anyway because it's just a different beast. So I think this is one of those issues where it's all your perspective. It's what you want, what you feel comfortable with. I don't know that there's any one silver bullet.
Alex.
And I think the voters have opinions, but do they really understand what it is like for the council people?
Of course not.
Yeah, and I would say one thing that has come out loud and clear in the past couple of weeks, remember that under state law, the council could just vote to do this and leave it at that, although 5,000 signatures would put it up for a referendum. The message has already resonated loudly enough that now council members are saying, okay, this is going to be a referendum, by the way, likely in November 2018.
Yeah, that's one of the questions they'll have to consider. They'll consider whether or not they want to do this and then how they're going to do it, because as you say, they can vote on this themselves and it can happen, but 5,000 signatures on a petition could overturn that. So maybe the best way to do that is just to send it to a referendum. At that committee meeting the other night, LaWanna Mayfield said council should make the decision. While Ed Driggs suggested putting it to the voters, Mayfield pointed to the fact that residents rejected the Uptown Arena for the Hornets, but city council decided to go ahead and do it anyway.
This community has historically voted against its best interest, Ed. This community voted against.
Do you understand what that means? In a democracy?
So
you're saying that people don't know what's good for them.
Wow.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. Fun for those of us in the media covering it anyway. December 3rd is the first night that the full council will debate it, and you can prepare for more exchanges like that.
Because that's exactly what happened. When the voters said no to the downtown arena, and then the city council came back right after the vote and said, we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
That was the big conversation. Oh, we don't know what we're talking about?
Yeah. And Mike, if you remember, a lot of the argument was it was a bundled package of projects. Every one of those projects wound up being built and with public money. So, yeah, you're right. They did all of it. So
I think this will end up, however they decide, it'll be end up being the opposite of the toll road, which got little attention when they were discussing it. And then people realized, oh, my gosh, this affects our lives. I think whatever they decide on this, people will eventually not care.
Yeah. Real quickly, Mike, one thing that is interesting is if you go in 2019 on the ballot, that's a municipal election, usually about 20% turnout as compared to a presidential or midterm.
Right. So very few people will be making this decision.
Yes.
But despite the 3-2 party line decision in the committee, our Steve Harrison reports that a poll conducted in late October of 385 active voters found that 62% opposed longer term. Now, 62% of 385 people is not a big number. And the poll was conducted by Forward Charlotte, which I formed before the last mayor's race to oppose Democrat Jennifer Roberts and is run by a Republican strategist. So does that taint the results?
It might,
but I would also point out that those numbers actually closely mirror the voter response when county commission when that came up.
It was 66-34.
It was 60-some opposed. Yeah. So, I mean, I just don't see this happening.
Why do Democrats want this, but Republicans, the two Republicans, don't? What's the reasoning?
One thing I wonder about with the two Republicans is, if you know it's going to go on the referendum anyway, you might like the idea of having a 4-year term, but it's easy to oppose it publicly and reap the benefits. So that's too conspiratorial of me. I don't know.
Okay.
It's not.
Well,
thank you, Glenn.
The election is over. The campaign commercials have stopped. Thank you, God.
The new ones start next week, Mike.
Anyway, that election saw substantial Democratic gains here and around the country and against extreme odds because of gerrymandered districts. Democrats broke the GOP supermajority in the legislature, of course. But this week, Common Cause of North Carolina and the North Carolina Democratic Party have filed a lawsuit against the General Assembly over the state's legislative maps, which the two groups say are unfairly stacked against Democrats. Why now?
Well, the head of the state Republican Party got a good quip out of this.
Yes, Dallas Woodhouse.
Dallas Woodhouse. He said only Democrats would sue over districts that they just won. But the argument from Common Cause and the Democratic Party is that the districts are so stacked that even with a blue wave, there's no chance of Democrats regaining the majority. Republicans are saying, look, you were happy with this for 100 years when you could draw the maps, but then when we got control, you didn't like it. There's some truth to that, but also, Mike, there is a more sophisticated method of gerrymandering now with computer programs and analytics. So I think most voters would like to see this taken away from the politicians.
Let's go back to a little bit, because Common Cause says that, I'm not sure everybody understands this, the Democrats won the total vote in both the House and Senate races, but they did not capture a majority of each of either house.
Not even close.
Yeah, and they went on to say that, as drawn, there is no conceivable way for Democrats to win a majority in either chamber because of gerrymandering. And the Republicans have little defense for this because they've come out publicly and said the only reason there are two Democrats in at all is because we couldn't figure out how to make it one.
Right, right. Because when you look at, we're talking about General Assembly, but then also when you look at the congressional delegation from North Carolina, it's 10-3 in favor of Republicans. The vote this past time was 50-48. So that shows you how imbalanced it is with gerrymandering. And we've talked about this a lot on this show, whether the Supreme Court will in fact take a look at North Carolina as a place where gerrymandering is unconstitutional on the basis of partisanship, not race. So that is still out there to be determined.
And the day before this lawsuit was filed, Mecklenburg State Senator Jeff Jackson, a Democrat, was on this program talking about gerrymandering, among other things. And he said then that there are many Republicans in the General Assembly ready to make redistricting fairer, and he floated one possible step they could take.
One idea is to take the State Board of Ethics and Elections, which the Republicans reformed, that basically made it four Republicans, four Democrats, and one unaffiliated picked by that group, and you make it the State Board of Ethics, Elections, and Redistricting, because they entrusted this group to make partisan decisions that affect elections by making it balanced. So if you're willing to do that with respect to election decisions, maybe you're willing to do that with respect to redistricting.
Now there's a question. Would Republicans be willing to do that?
That's a good question. I still think that whenever we talk about gerrymandering, if I can say it, and redistricting, the party that's in power, what would motivate them to give up power?
Right.
I think that you're going to have to do this
fairness,
through the courts.
Patriotism.
those are noble characteristics, Mike, but I'm a little bit doubtful.
Especially when the party that's in power is not winning the popular vote.
Yeah.
And they literally would be giving up power.
So would you say then that we actually do live in a blue state? We just can't show it because it's the deck is stacked?
I think it leans blue. I don't think it's entirely a blue state.
But with so many people now being unaffiliated voters and maybe they switch back and forth, right, do we really know if it's blue or red?
And the demographics are changing because people are moving here from elsewhere. The 9th Congressional District is still, the networks, for whatever power they may have still not called the 9th Congressional District, although Mark Harris went to Washington on Monday to go through orientation as the new representative from the 9th. When are we going to know what the official final count on the 9th District is? Do anybody know?
Aren't we supposed to know? I'm trying to remember. The canvassing is today for Mecklenburg County.
But I don't know if that's true for every county.
I think for the state, it is Monday of next week, Monday or Tuesday. So I think we should know by the middle of next week. But there's no challenge, Mike. There's no
right.
I mean, there. I don't see any way this is being undone.
Okay.
Well,
we're not
talking
Florida.
About are we red or blue? And I think what we are partly is blue cities and red
absolutely
rural areas, which is a really important dynamic that's still out there.
And the
too
people who live in the cities is the bulk of the population.
Yeah, and the suburbs. That's why there's all this talk about the suburbs, because that's kind of the no man's land.
Right. Well, one of the Republicans who lost in this last election, because we had a clean sweep of the county commission. There are no Republicans coming up in, I think, when do they get sworn in, December or January?
December 3rd.
After that, there will be no Republicans on county commission. And one of the Republicans who lost was longtime county commissioner Bill James. And as a result, Bill James told Channel 9's Joe Bruno in an email, there is one left, meaning meeting. There's one meeting left for the old board, and I elect to skip it. That is not unusual and is completely at my discretion, meaning he'll skip the last meeting before the new members are sworn in. But then he blocked nearly everybody from his Twitter account, changed its setting to private, did the same thing for his Facebook account. And people in the press are all a flutter about this, but isn't that just a guy transitioning from public to private life?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that people in the media are taken with it is he has been so divisive and he's been so, I guess, recalcitrant. He's a guy who likes to mix it up publicly. And so it's a little bit of a surprise that he would go quiet that quickly.
And I think you're right. I think the timing of it. It just happened a little fast after the election. I think in January or even after the new county commission is sworn in, I think people might have looked at it a little differently.
Imagine if it was someone in a higher elected office, like a senator or, Robert Pittenger just turned off all of his public, facing methods of communication.
Why do you think he did it then? He says it's because he wants to become private.
Well, I think, yeah, he probably does want to become private. I think he's also very disappointed and frustrated.
Well, he didn't campaign.
And he's never been a schmoozy kind of guy. Oh, he's never been out pressing the flesh. He's done his communication electronically, and he's never been, a flatterer. And part of this, he sent an email to Dina DiOrio, the county manager, and said, "Need help boxing and moving all the junk in my office. Add my nameplate from the dais to the pile. If the new board ends up awarding me the Order of the Hornet, I won't be there. Just mail it to me." So again, it sort of has that feel of walking out with a middle finger in the air.
Yeah, I was going to say,
that's kind of Bill's style.
Yeah, I emailed him. When you correspond with him by email, he will give you very detailed answers, but he does remain defiant. I asked him about possibly running again. He said, quote, "I am ready to collect my county retirement money." So yeah, he's not
I don't think he's
out.
Given up any paychecks either on the way out the
is
door.
Is there county retirement money for county commissions? Is there?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't either.
There must be.
He thinks so.
Yeah, he thinks so.
I feel a 30-part series coming.
but it is interesting because Bill James has been in office 22 years. He has been so loud and vocal about so many issues. He does not back down from a fight. And even though he's defiant in these little exchanges, he is essentially just saying, you know what?
Yeah.
I'm out of here.
And he's never called to concede or to congratulate Susan Rodriguez McDowell, who will succeed him.
Wouldn't hold my breath for that one.
No. For what it's worth, I'm told the New York Times did call the 9th Congressional District for Mark Harris, but they're not a network. They're a newspaper. The AP hasn't. New York Times has. But what about the William Brawley, Bill Brawley, Rachel Hunt race? Have they called that yet?
No,
I think it'll be today that they'll officially call it. But Rachel Hunt, last week we were on this roundup talking about how Rachel Hunt had not conceded. Now she has declared victory. She is, I think, 62, 67?
Something like that, yeah.
She went from being 52 votes behind when they got the next round of, what was it, the provisional ballots got counted.
Yeah.
She's now,
And that's been steady, Ann, ever since they got those in. It's been about a 60-vote margin.
Well, for those people who are against the I-77 toll lanes, good news, you can't use them.
We'll fix that.
No tolls for you.
It's like, no tolls for you. We're going to come back and talk about it. They're a little late on the opening of those toll lanes, and then among many other things left to talk about in the next 20 minutes or so on the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal. Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Alex Olgan from WFAE News. And Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. The I-77 toll lanes were supposed to be operational by the end of this year. I kept driving I-70. I've been driving I-77 up and down and up and
down.
Are
you a masochist?
Yes, in a word. But I've been thinking... this is never going to be done, never going to be done by the end of the year. And I was right. They will not be done. And the Business Journal reported this week that I-77 Mobility Partners, the offshoot of the Spanish company Cintra that will run this thing for 50 years and take all the revenue, said that only a portion would be opened at year's end at reduced tolls. How kind of them. There will be ultimately be 26 miles of toll lanes. How much and which portions will be opening before the beginning of the year?
They have not given specific figures. They've said that the northern end will be ready by the end of the year. They have also, I think, perhaps conflated some of this because, remember, you had some interchanges that were added later in the project, which they and others expected to be late. But what we can't tell is what about some of the other southern portions? At least that has not been made clear to me in my communications with them. But what caught me by surprise, and I think some other reporters, is so there are these penalties, Mike, for
$10,000 a day.
$10,000 a day, and we kept hearing January 1st, end of the year. And now when this news comes out, it also comes with the news that the deadline has been pushed back to November 1st of 2019, which means it's very unlikely that they will end up paying penalties.
So another year of this?
Well, they're saying the first half of the year they'll be finished, but the deadline, if things were to go wrong, they have all the way until October 31st.
But not only do they have to – they have all these flyover bridges that are going up and lanes. Yeah. I don't know what they're for, but they're going up. And they're in very early stages of construction. And then they have to go through and repave all of the existing I-77 that they tore up to move all these lanes around for construction purposes. That'll be a nightmare.
Yeah, and part of that repaving, they're saying, is a general improvement for everyone because the free lanes will also be upgraded.
And they're paying for that? Cintra is paying
They are
for that?
Paying for that, and that's part of the reason the price has gone from $650 to $670 million. But I want to go back to where you started, Mike, which is driving up and down 77, noticing the progress of the construction. When Secretary of Transportation Jim Trogdon was here for a meeting at the end of the summer, I remember Eli Portillo from The Observer, myself, Joe Bruno, others, we had all just driven up 77 and looked at that and said, there is no way you guys are going to be ready, are you? And, you know, the representatives, Cintra said, we're still on schedule for end of the year. And here
pay
we
no
are.
Attention to that man
that's
behind
right,
the curtain.
Exactly. So that's, that's life reporting, yeah. I guess.
Okay, so this week Amazon announced that not one, but two cities would become their second North American headquarters. Is it 2 and 3, or are they just calling it 2A and 2B?
3, 4, 5.
Queens, New York, Long Island City, I think, and Crystal City in the D.C. suburbs of Arlington, Virginia. Now, I can't speak for the New York City Metro, but I can for Crystal City because I grew up around the corner from there. Why would anybody want to... Why would anybody want the hassle of having to go to work there every day? It's a wasteland of it's an office park. That's what it is. It's an office park on the Potomac.
You make it sound so inviting.
It's an office park surrounded by a parking lot.
That's right. And access to 95, which is also a parking lot most of the time. Now, anyway, so that aside.
They must have gotten some pretty sweet incentives.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Only reason, aside from that, perhaps, I can think of is that somebody at Amazon actually watched the video that we sent as part of our pitch.
In Charlotte, we call our downtown uptown. But y'all will get used to that once you come round.
There's a hum here in Charlotte. We're moving and buzzing. We're the number 3 city for banking. We're like New York's polite cousin. And we have sunshine.
Yeah. That aside, the...
Are you getting royalties every time you play that?
By the way, what could go wrong?
I love it. That aside, we're going to put that in squawks. That aside, the D.C. suburbs were long rumored to be Amazon's choice, as was New York City. And there are people who believe that perhaps this whole thing was a ruse, that it was just a way to leverage and get more incentives, and also to get a lot of data from the cities, the 200-plus cities that put in a bid. Were we played?
Pretty good advertising campaign, too. You get a lot of attention, a lot of mentions. I think the 236 cities that lost out feel like they were played in a lot of ways. And to throw salt in the wound, Mike, you didn't mention the fact that Amazon threw in 5,000 jobs to Nashville, which seems to beat every city in North Carolina for every economic development project. But, yeah, I think there's a lot of frustration on the bigger question of, did they know all along where they were going? Because these are not surprise cities by any stretch.
So I asked Mayor Lyles when she was here yesterday on the program about whether she thought we'd been played, but she saw a larger question that we should be asking ourselves.
Nationally, the question is now going to be, should we be doing this kind of national competition, or should we be investing in the fundamentals of our city so that people say, I want to come?
Some say that we dodged a bullet. People in Seattle would say we dodged a bullet because of what has happened to traffic and congestion and housing prices out there. Is that what she's saying, or merely that we shouldn't chase shiny baubles but instead make ourselves a place that people really want to come to on their own?
Yeah, I think she's door number two, which is if you focus on the fundamentals, then you don't have to go out and convince people to come here. They're going to want to be here. And a lot of people use the example of Northern California. That's certainly not a cheap place to live, but they have all the brains, so that's where people go.
Yeah, but there's a little more to Northern California than just Silicon Valley. That area has been expensive for a long time, And I doubt that if we had won Amazon, that we would have seen our cost of living and housing prices match San Francisco or Seattle or whatever. I think it's hard to argue that we dodged a bullet by not getting one of the prize jewels in economic development.
Now, the Observer and probably some other organizations have asked repeatedly to see the Charlotte Regional Partnership's bid, because they're the entity that put the bid in. The city of Charlotte didn't bid for this. They did. And we've been denied this lovely opportunity. We do have that. We could play that thing again. but that's the only thing we've seen is that video from the pitch. Will we get to see it now that we're definitely out of the running, the decision is over? Will we get to see it?
Yes, because I think the reasoning had been that Raleigh was allegedly still in the running, and that part of our bid was the North Carolina's incentives. So that was somehow keeping that secret was important. And now that there is no chance that anyone in North Carolina is getting it, they are saying they will release it in, I think, the next 25 days.
Yes, that's okay. Right. Well, that'll be interesting.
Yeah, that'll be very interesting because, Mike, it was $1.5 billion worth of incentives in New York and $600 million in Northern Virginia, and we all want to know, what was Charlotte offering?
Okay. Sunshine.
Yes. And
maybe
buzz.
We'll learn how
buzz
much...
and sunshine.
And
yes.
A downtown that's called Uptown.
Maybe we'll find out how much they paid for the video.
Yes.
Want to hear it again? No, I didn't think so. All right. City Council will soon decide about whether to approve the spending of $115 million to expand and upgrade the Charlotte Convention Center. Where will that money be spent?
So they're going to add a bunch of meeting space, about 93,000 square feet, and they're also going to build a pedestrian bridge linking over Stonewall Street so that you connect better between the convention center and the Westin, which is the main convention hotel in town, and the Whole Foods and all those things, trying to make it a little bit more walkable.
Are we losing business because we're not state-of-the-art? We're 5 years old, 5 minutes old?
Yes, there's still always that debate. Yeah. And also, Mike, Thousand Room Hotel has also been part of the conversation. We'll see where that goes.
And this money comes from the hotel motel tax?
Yes.
There was a time when city planners were kind of down on those overhead walkways. There's one gone up now over Church Street, and now we'll have another.
Yes.
Is that debate now closed?
Well, this one is not part of the Overstreet Mall, so this is outdoor pedestrian access. They're trying to make a clean route from South End all the way through Uptown is what they're trying to do, where you can just walk all the way. So I think that's separate from the argument you're talking about.
Okay.
Back to school for a moment. More lead's been found in the drinking water at four Mecklenburg schools. Is that correct? How do they find it? What do we know about it? When are they getting rid of it?
Well, this is the ongoing. They did a round of testing where they caught a lot of flack because they did not immediately notify families of the results. They said, well, we're going to keep doing this. We're going to be very open about it. So round two is 35 schools. They've completed the testing on 15. 11 of them came up clean, and then they found, I think fortunately, none of this sounds like things that were really students being highly exposed. There were, I think, two classroom sinks at a small alternative high school performance learning center, a sink in the press box concession stand at West Charlotte High, a sink at an administrative building.
Why would it be scattered plumbing throughout a building? Why just sinks in certain water fountains? Why not building-wide? That's odd to me.
Well, they don't think, apparently, that it's the pipes, and they certainly, again, this is not like Flint, Michigan. They don't think that the water supply itself is contaminated. This is old sinks and drinking fountains where they think that it's actually those fixtures themselves that, especially if the water sits overnight, lead starts leaching out into them. So that was part of the debate with the other ones, is that CMS was saying that, you know, there was very little chance of exposure, that was not a constant supply of lead gushing out. In a lot of cases, they were fixtures that were not heavily used by students and or faculty. Right. People are very skeptical.
But nobody's been hurt by this. So as far as we know.
I don't think we know, right.
Okay. Atrium Health and the North Carolina and United States Justice Departments, yesterday I think it was, settled a 2016 antitrust lawsuit about healthcare pricing. What was the suit about? What's the settlement entail, Alex?
Okay, so the suit is about what's called anti-steering provisions. Now, it's normal for insurance companies to make deals with certain hospitals and say, hey, patients, you should go here, you can get a better deal. But what was the Justice Department saw problematic with these deals is, as part of those contracts, Atrium said, oh, but you also can't encourage people to go to other places. You can only encourage people to go to our place, and therefore we can raise prices sort of unfettered. And that was the Justice Department's argument. Now, Atrium in this settlement doesn't say they did anything wrong. They don't have to pay any fines or any penalties. They just say they're going to make changes going forward.
In fact, they said they encourage competition.
They did say that. And they also said that some of this language was quite old. What's interesting is part of the settlement, assuming it's approved by a judge, which it hasn't formally been, is that the attorney general can now look at the language in those contracts.
So how will this affect healthcare, patients, doctors, the hospital itself?
It might be a while because they have like 270 days, Atrium does, to come up with a plan about how they're going to comply with this. You probably won't even notice anything until the next open enrollment period at the earliest. But if you do notice something, maybe you'll notice that there's comparisons. Now you can look at, you know, get an MRI cheaper down the street.
There's also a new pilot program at six North Carolina hospitals. I think Novant Presbyterian is one of them, where they've brought in what they call peer support specialists. To deal with people coming into the emergency room who have problems with drug abuse or drug overdose?
Yeah, or alcohol or mental health issues. I mean, it's some infusion from this federal opioid treatment dollars that's gone to a bunch of different states. And one of the things that health leaders think is a good idea here is to reach people when they're coming in.
So these peer support specialists are people who have had problems themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
So they know what they're talking about.
Well, that's the theory. Exactly. They know what they're talking about. They can talk to someone on a non-medical terminology level, just say, hey, I've been there. I know how you feel. This worked for me. Let's see if I can help you.
And get moving, America. The federal government came out with new guidelines for physical activity. I know you're going in depth because you're hosting this show next week for a day, and you're going in depth on this during that program. But in a nutshell, what should we be doing?
Walk more. Do anything. Exactly. In fact, I read this morning's stories while walking in the treadmill. So I'm taking those guidelines seriously.
Impressive.
But the guidelines aren't all that different. They're just trying to say now, like, even smaller amounts of physical activity, like taking the stairs instead of the elevator, walking to get coffee at work, that'll count towards your 20 minutes a day. Just do anything to move is basically what they're saying.
So get one of those desks that
you can
lift
exactly.
up.
Exactly. Do anything to keep walking.
Do anything to keep walking. It was sadly reported yesterday afternoon that the North Carolina teacher who went missing in Mexico on October 28th has been found dead. And authorities, quote, are searching for those responsible to bring them to justice. The teacher was Patrick Braxton Andrew, a Davidson College graduate. What else do we know, Anne, if anything?
I don't know much about that at all.
I'm not sure he was found yet. I know that they had concluded that he had been killed by a criminal element in that area that was operating in that area. The last I read, they were still looking for the body, however.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I don't know where I found the word found, but I took,
well, maybe,
it, from, I took
maybe,
it from something.
The family has definitely said that they've been told that he's dead, but that, I agree with Glenn. Last I saw was that they were still looking for the body.
Okay. In Huntersville, the new 11-member commission, the new Educational Option Study Commission, formed to study charter schools and had their first meeting on Monday night. Is this another step toward investigating a split from CMS?
Well, this is a few weeks ago, both Huntersville and I believe Cornelius formed their own study commissions. Meanwhile, they're also participating in the countywide one that includes all of the municipalities and CMS. But yes, the things that are on the table for them to look at include forming their own charter schools, working with CMS, doing nothing, and I think they also put splitting up with CMS, which is sort of one of those, you know, put the most dramatic option on the table, as unlikely as it appears to be at this point.
That appears to be in every suburban neighborhood's hope chest.
That's a memorable way to put it, Mike.
Meanwhile, Hugh McManaway is back. Have you noticed? Has anybody driven past him?
He is back, and he's under heavier fortification now. So I think Hugh's in good shape for the Thanksgiving holiday, busy travel season.
If people don't know who we're...
Who's going to be the first person to dress him up now that he's in his new location?
Hugh McManaway is the gold statue at the corner of Queens and Queens, Providence and Providence. He's been there for years, and he disappeared about a year ago when a car, for the 19 zillionth time, hit the statue and really did some damage. But they've repaired the damage, and as you say, they put him up now on a fortified pedestal.
Yes.
So they can't, you know, all the years that he used to stand out in the middle of the road and direct traffic, he never had a
problem. Scratch. Never a scratch.
So we're glad he's back. We're glad he's back. And we're glad you're all back, too. Alex Olgan from WFAE News and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins, editor, publisher, QCityMetro.com. And Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.